You must draw water and clean the cave. Barley has to be ground. Shall I clean your inner cave first, venerable one? Asked the young monk. No, I will do that myself after I have rested, but do you fetch extra sand for me and leave it here. He rummaged idly in a small recess in one of the stone walls. After eating tsampa and nothing but tsampa for more than 80 years, he said somewhat wistfully, I feel a strange longing to taste other food even once before passing on to where I shall not need any. He shook his white old head and added, probably the shock of different food would kill me. With that he wandered into his private section of the eave, a section which the young monk had not entered. The young monk fetched a stout splintered branch from the entrance to the cave, and vigorously set to loosen the impacted floor of the cave. Scraping away the hardened surface, he swept the whole mass out into the open and scattered it well away so as not to obstruct the entrance with the discarded material. Wearily, he trudged and trudged again and again from lakeside to cave, carrying in his upturned robe as much sand as he could lift. Carefully he strewed the floor with the fresh sand and stamped it down. 6 more trips to the shore and he had enough sand for the old hermit. At the inner end of the cave was a smooth-topped rock with a water-worn depression formed eons ago. Into the depression he ladled 2 handfuls of barley. The heavy, rounded stone nearby was the obvious tool kept for the purpose. Raising it with some effort, the young monk wondered how so ancient a man as the hermit, blind and enfeebled by deprivation, could manage it. But the barley, already roasted, had to be ground. Bringing the stone down with a resounding thud, he gave it a half rotation and back before raising the stone for another blow. Monotonously he went on, pounding the barley, rotating the stone to crush the grains finer, scooping the pulverized flour out and replacing it with more grain. Thud. 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 At last, with arms and back aching, he was satisfied with the amount. Wiping the rock and stone with sand to remove clinging grain, he carefully put the ground material in the old box kept for that purpose, and moved tiredly to the entrance to the cave. The late afternoon sun still shone warmly. The young monk lay on a rock and idly stirred his tsampa with a forefinger to mix it. On the branch a small bird perched, head to one side, watching everything with cheeky confidence. From the still waters of the lake a large fish leapt in a successful attempt to catch a low-flying insect. Nearby, at the base of a tree, some rodent was busily burrowing, quite oblivious of the presence of the young monk. A cloud obscured the warmth of the sun's rays and the young man shivered at the sudden chill. Jumping to his feet he swilled his bowl clear and polished it with sand. The bird flew off chirping in alarm, and the rodent scurried around the tree trunk and watched events with a bright and beady eye. Stuffing the bowl in the front of his robe, the young monk hurried off to the cave. In the cave the old hermit was sitting, no longer erect, but with his back against a wall. I would like to feel the warmth of a fire upon me once again, he said, for I have not been able to prepare a fire for myself during the past 60 years and more. Will you light one for me and we will sit by the cave mouth? Most certainly, replied the young monk. Do you have flint or tinder? No, I have nothing but my bowl, my barley box and my robes. I do not even possess a blanket. So the young monk placed his own tattered blanket around the shoulders of the older man, and went out into the open. A short distance from the cave an old rock fall had littered the ground with debris. Here the young monk carefully selected 2 round flints which fitted comfortably in his palm. Experimentally he struck them together with a scraping motion and was gratified to obtain a thin stream of sparks at the first attempt. Putting the 2 flints in the front of his robe he made his way to a dead and hollow tree which obviously had been struck by lightning and killed a long time ago. In the hollow interior he probed and scratched and eventually tore off handfuls of white bone dry wood, rotten and powdery. Carefully he put it inside his robe, then picked up dry and brittle branches which were scattered all around the tree. Laden so that his strength was sorely taxed, He made his slow way back to the cave and thankfully dumped his load by the outer side of the entrance away from the prevailing wind so that later the cave should not be filled with smoke. In the sandy soil he scooped a shallow depression and with his two flints beside him and the dry sticks broken into lengths he first laid a criss-cross of small twigs and covered them with the rotten wood which he rolled and twisted between his hands until it was reduced almost to the consistency of flour. Grimly he bent over, and grasping the two flints, one in each hand, he struck them sideways together so that the poor little stream of sparks should land in the tinder wood. Again and again he tried until at last a minute particle of flame appeared. Lowering himself so that his chest was on the ground, he carefully, oh so carefully, blew towards the precious spark. Slowly it grew brighter. Slowly the minute spot grew until the young man was able to stretch out his hand and place small dry twigs around the area with some bridging the space. He blew and eventually had the satisfaction of seeing actual flame grow and move along the twigs. No mother devoted more care to her firstborn than the young man devoted to the baby fire. Gradually it grew and became brighter. At last, triumphantly, he placed larger and larger sticks on the fire which began to blaze eagerly. Into the cave he went to the old hermit. "Venerable one," the young monk said, "your fire is ready. May I assist you?" Into the old man's hand he placed a stout staff, and helping him slowly to his feet he put an arm around the thin body and helped him carefully to a place beside the fire and away from the smoke. "I will go and collect more wood for the night," said the young monk, "but first I will place these flints and the tinder in the cave so that they will remain dry." So saying, he readjusted the blanket around his senior's shoulders, placed water beside him, and took the flints and the tinder into the cave to a place beside the barley box. Leaving the cave, the young monk piled more wood on the fire and made sure the old man was safe from any chance flame, then setting off he headed for the campsite which the traders had used. They might have left some wood, he thought. But no, they had left no wood at all. Better than wood, though, they had overlooked a metal container. Obviously it had fallen unnoticed when the yaks were loaded, or when they were moving off. Perhaps another yak had bumped this container free and it had fallen behind a rock. Now, to the young monk, it was treasure indeed. Now water could be heated. A stout spike lay beneath the can. What its purpose was the young monk could not even guess, but it would be useful for something, he was sure. Industriously poking around in the grove of trees, he soon had a very satisfactory pile of wood. Journey after journey he made back to the cave dragging branches, carrying sticks. Not yet did he tell the old hermit of his finds. He wanted to be able to stay then and savor the full pleasure of the old man's satisfaction at having some hot water. Tea he had, for the trader had provided some, yet there had been no means of heating water until now. The last load of wood was too light, it would have been a wasted journey. The young monk wandered around looking for a suitable branch. By a thicket near the water's edge he suddenly saw a pile of old rags. How they got there he could not say. Astonishment gave way to desire. He moved forward to pick up the rags and jumped a foot in the air when they groaned. Bending down he saw that the rags was a man thin beyond belief. Around his neck he wore a kang, a slab of wood each side of which was about 2.5 feet long. It was divided into two halves held together at one side by a hinge, and at the opposite side by a hasp and padlock. The center of the wood was shaped to fit round the neck of the wearer. The man was a living skeleton. The young monk dropped to his knees and pushed aside fronds of the thicket, then rising to his feet he hurried to the water and filled his bowl. Quickly he returned to the fallen man and dripped water into the slightly open mouth. The man stirred and opened his eyes. He sighed with contentment at the sight of the monk bending over him. "I tried to drink," he mumbled, "and fell in. With this board I floated and nearly drowned. I was in the water for days and just recently was able to climb out." He paused, exhausted. The young monk gave him more water and then water well mixed with barley flour. "Can you get this thing off?" the man asked. If you hit this lock sideways between two stones, it will spring open. The young monk rose to his feet and went to the lakeside for two substantial stones. Returning, he placed the larger stone beneath one edge of the rock and gave it a hearty thwack with the other. "Try the other edge," said the man, "and hit it where that pin goes through. Then pull it down hard." Carefully, the young monk turned the lock edge for edge and gave it a hearty bonk where advised. Pulling it downwards after, he was rewarded by a rusty creak, and the lock came apart. Gently he opened the slab of wood and released the man's neck, which was chafed so deeply that the blood was oozing. "We will burn this," said the young monk, "pity to waste it." Chapter 3. For some time the young monk sat on the ground cradling the sick man's head and trying to feed him small amounts of tsanpa. At last he stood up and said, "I shall have to carry you to the cave of the hermit." So saying, he lifted up the man and managed to get him over one shoulder, face down, and folded like a rolled up blanket. Staggering under the weight, he made his way out of the little grove of trees and set out upon the stony path to the cave. At last, after what seemed to be an endless journey, he reached the fireside. Gently he allowed the man to slide to the ground. "Venerable one," he said, "I found this man in a thicket beside a lake. He had a kang around his neck and he is very sick. I removed the kang and have brought him here." With a branch the young monk stirred the fire so that the sparks rose upwards and the air was filled with the pleasant scent of burning wood. Pausing only to pile on more wood, he turned back to the old hermit. "The kang, eh?" said the latter. "That means he is a convict, but what is a convict doing here? No matter what he has done, if he is sick we must do what we can. Perhaps the man can speak?"
"Yes, venerable one," muttered the man in a weak voice. "I am too far gone to be helped physically, I need help spiritually so that I may die in peace. May I talk to you?"
"Most certainly," replied the old hermit.
"Speak, and we will listen."
The sick man moistened his lips with water passed to him by the young monk, cleared his throat, and said, "I was a successful silversmith in the city of Lhasa. Business was good, even from the lamasaries came work. Then, O blights of blights, Indian traders came and made available cheap goods from the bazaars of India. Things they called mass-produced. Inferior, shoddy. Stuff I would not touch. My business fell off. Money became short. My wife could not face adversity, so she went to the bed of another. To the bed of a rich trader who had coveted her before I married her. A trader who as yet was not touched by the Indian competitors. I had no one to help me. No one to care. And no one for whom I could care." He stopped, overcome by his bitter thoughts. The old hermit and the young monk kept silent, waiting for him to recover. At last he continued, "Competition increased, there came a man from China bringing even cheaper goods by the yakload. My business ceased. I had nothing but my meager supplies which no one wanted. At last an Indian trader came to me and offered an insultingly low price for my home and all that was in it. I refused, and he jeered at me saying that soon he would have it for nothing. Being hungry and sick at heart, I lost my temper and threw him out of my house. He landed on his head in the roadway and cracked his temple on a chance stone." Again the sick man stopped, overcome by his thoughts. Again the others kept silent while they waited for him to continue. "I was surrounded by throngs," he went on, "some blaming me and some speaking out in favor. Soon I was dragged before a magistrate and the tale was told. Some spoke to the magistrate for me, some spoke against me. He deliberated but a short time before sentencing me to wear the kang for a year. The device was fetched and locked around my neck. With it on I could not feed myself, nor give myself drink, but was always dependent upon the good offices of others. I could not work and had to wander begging for, not merely food, but for someone to feed me. I could not lie down, but had always to stand or sit." He turned even paler, and appeared to be at the point of collapse. The young monk said, "Venerable one, I found a container at the site of the trader camp.
I will fetch it and then can make tea. Rising to his feet, he hurried off down the path to where he had left the container, the spike and the kang. Casting about and delving into the undergrowth springing up around the former camp, he found a hook that evidently belonged to the container. Filling the container with water, after scrubbing it with sand, he set off back along the path, carrying the can of water, hook, spike and kang. Soon he was back and with great glee tossed the heavy kang straight on the fire. Sparks shot up and clouds of smoke billowed out, while from the neck hole in the center of the kang a solid column of flame funneled out. The young monk rushed into the cave and brought out the bundles given him by the trader so recently. Brick tea. A large and very solid cake of yak butter, dusty, quite a bit rancid, but still recognizable as butter. A rare treat, a small sack of brown sugar. Outside, by the fire, he carefully slid a smooth stick through the handle of the can and placed it in the center of the bright fire. Sliding out the stick, he placed it carefully to one side. The tea brick was already broken in places, so he selected some of the smaller lumps and dropped them in the water, which was now beginning to get hot. A quarter of the hard butter was hacked off with the aid of a sharp flat stone. Into the now bubbling water it went, to melt and spread a thick yellow film over the surface. A small lump of borax, part of a larger lump in the tea bag, went next in order to improve the flavor, and then, oh, wonderful treat, a whole handful of brown sugar. Seizing a freshly peeled stick, the young monk stirred the mess vigorously. Now the whole surface was obscured by steam, so he slid the stick under the handle and lifted out the can. The old hermit had been following the proceedings with great interest. By sounds he had been alert to each stage of the matter. Now, without being asked, he held out his bowl. The young monk took it, and skimming the scum of dirt, sticks and froth from the concoction, half filled the old man's bowl before carefully returning it to him. The convict whispered that he had a bowl in his rags. Bringing it out, he was offered a full bowl of tea in the knowledge that he, having sight, would not spill any. The young monk filled his own bowl and sank back to drink it with the sigh of satisfaction that comes to those who have worked hard for anything. For a time all was quiet as each sat engrossed with his own thoughts. From time to time the young monk rose to fill the bowls of his companions or his own. The evening grew dark, a chill wind sighed through the trees making leaves whisper in protest. The waters of the lake grew, rippled, and waves soughed and sighed among the pebbles of the foreshore. Gently the young monk took the old hermit by the hand and led him back into the now dark interior of the cave, then returned for the sick man. He roused from his sleep as the young monk lifted him. "I must talk," he said, "for there is little life left within me." The young monk carried him inside the cave and scooped a depression for his hip bone and made a mound for his head. A journey outside to heap sandy soil around the fire to damp it down and keep it as moulder throughout the night. By the morrow the ashes would still be red and it would be easy to rekindle into vigorous flame. With the three men, one ancient, one middle-aged, and one just approaching manhood, sitting or lying close together, the convict spoke again. "My time grows short," he said, "I feel that my ancestors are ready to greet me and welcomed me home. For a year one have suffered and starved. For a year one have wandered from Lhasa to Fari and back seeking food, seeking aid. Seeking. I have seen great lamas who spurned me and others who were kind. I have seen the lowly give to me when they had to go hungry for it. For a year one have wandered even as the most lowly nomad. I have fought with dogs for their scraps, and then found I could not reach my mouth." He stopped and took a drink of the cold tea which stood beside him, now thick with congealed butter. "But how did you reach us?" asked the old hermit in his quavery voice. "I bent to the water at the very far end of the lake to drink, and the kang overbalanced me so that I fell in. A strong wind blew me far across the water so that I saw the night and the day and the night which followed and the day after. Birds perched upon the kang and tried to peck my eyes, but I shouted and frightened them off. Still I drifted at a fast rate until I lost consciousness and knew no more how long I drifted.
Earlier today my feet touched the bottom of the lake and roused me. Overhead a vulture was circling, so I struggled and crawled ashore to fall head first into the thicket where the young father found me. I am overtaxed, my strength is gone, and soon I shall be in the heavenly fields. Rest for the night, said the old hermit. The spirits of the night are astir. We must do our astral journeys ere it be too late. With the aid of his stout staff he climbed to his feet and hobbled to the inner portion of the cave. The young monk gave a little tsampa to the sick man, settled him more comfortably, and then lay down to think over the events of the day and so to fall asleep. The moon rose to her full height and majestically moved to the other side of the sky. The noises of the night changed from hour to hour. Here insects droned and whirred, while from afar came the frightened shriek of a night bird. The mountain range crackled as the rocks cooled and contracted in the night air. Nearby Rockwell lent thunder to the night as rocks and mountain debris came tumbling down to pound a tattoo on the hard-packed earth. A night rodent called urgently to its mate, and unknown things rustled and murmured in the whispering sands. Gradually the stars paled and the first shafts heralding a new day shot across the sky. Suddenly, as though electrified, the young monk sat bolt upright. Wide awake he sat, staring vainly, trying to pierce the intense darkness of the cave. Holding his breath he concentrated on listening. No robbers would come here, he thought. Everyone knew that the old hermit had nothing. The old hermit was ill, the young monk wondered. Rising to his feet he felt a cautious way to the end of the cave. Venerable one. Are you all right? He called. The sounds of the old man stirring. Yes, is it our guest, maybe? The young monk felt foolish, having completely forgotten the convict. Turning he hurried to where the entrance of the cave showed as a dim grey blur. Yes, the well-protected fire was still alive. Grasping a stick the young monk thrust it into the heart of the red and blue steadily. Flame appeared and he piled more sticks upon the awakening blaze. By now the first stick was well alight at the end. Seizing it, he turned and hurried into the cave. The burning brand sent weird shadows dancing crazily on the walls. The young monk jumped as a figure loomed into the feeble torchlight. It was the old hermit. At the young monk's feet the convict lay huddled, legs drawn up to his chest. The torch reflected in his wide-open eyes, giving them the impression of winking. The mouth drooped open and a thin line of dried blood wandered from the corners down his cheeks and formed a turgid pool by his ears. Suddenly there came a rattling gurgle and the body twitched spasmodically, heaved up into a taut bow and relaxed with a violent and final exhalation of breath. The body creaked and there was the gurgle of fluids. The limbs became limp and the features flaccid. The old hermit and the young monk together intoned the service for the release of departing spirits and gave telepathic directions for his passage to the heavenly fields. Outside the cave the light became brighter. Birds began to sing as a fresh day was born, but here there was death. You will have to remove the body, said the old hermit. You must dismember it and remove the entrails so that the vultures can ensure a proper air burial. We have no knife, venerable one, protested the young monk. I have a knife, replied the hermit. I am keeping it that my own death may be properly conducted. Here it is. Do your duty and return the knife to me. Reluctantly the young monk picked up the dead body and carried it out of the cave. Near the rockfall there was a large flat slab of stone. With much effort he lifted the body onto the level surface and removed the soiled and tattered rags. High overhead there sounded the beating of heavy wings. The first vultures had appeared at the odor of death. Shuddering, the young monk plunged the point of the knife into the thin abdomen and drew it down. From the gaping wounds the intestines came bulging out. Quickly he grasped the slimy coils and pulled them out. On the rock he spread the heart, liver, kidneys and stomach. Hacking and twisting he cut off the arms and legs. With naked body covered with blood he hurried from the dreadful scene and rushed to the lake. Into the water he rushed, and scrubbed himself with handfuls of fine wet sand. Carefully he washed the old hermit's knife and scoured it clean with sand. Now he was shivering with cold and shock. The wind blew icy upon his nude body. The water trickling down felt almost as though the fingers of death were drawing lines upon his shuddering skin. Quickly he leapt out of the water and shook himself like a dog. Running, he drove a little warmth back into his body. By the cave mouth he picked up and donned his robe, previously discarded so that it would not be soiled by contact with the dismembered dead. Just as he was about to enter the cave he remembered his task was not completed. Slowly he retraced his steps to the stone where vultures still fought over the choicest morsels. The young man was amazed at how little was left of the body. Some vultures sat contentedly on nearby rocks and placidly preened their feathers, others pecked hopefully among the exposed ribs of the corpse. Already they had removed all the skin from the head, leaving the skull bare. Picking up a heavy rock, the young monk brought it down with shattering force on the skeletal skull, cracking it like an eggshell and, as intended, exposing the brains for the ever-hungry vultures. Then, grabbing the rags and bowl of the dead man, he rushed back to the fire and tossed rags and bowl into the blazing center. To one side, still red-hot, there lay the metal parts of the Kang, the last and only remnants of what had once been a wealthy craftsman with a wife, houses, and high skills. Pondering the matter, the young monk turned about and entered the cave. The old hermit was sitting in meditation but roused as his junior approached. "Men is temporary, men is frail," he said. "Life on earth is but illusion and the greater reality lies beyond. We will break our fast and then continue the transfer of knowledge, for until I have told you all I cannot leave my body, and I then want you to do for me what you have just done for our friend the convict. Now, though, let us eat, for we must maintain our strength as best we can. Do you fetch water and heat it? Now with my end so near, I can afford to indulge my body to that small extent." The young monk picked up the can and walked out of the cave and down to the lakeside, fastidiously avoiding the place where he had washed off the dead man's blood. Carefully he scoured the can inside and out. Carefully he scoured the old hermit's bowl as well as his own. Filling the can with water, he carried it in his left hand and dragged along a very substantial branch with his right. A solitary vulture came swooping down to see what was happening. Landing heavily, it hopped a few steps then flapped into the air again with a shriek of anger at having been fooled. Further up to the left, an overgorged vulture was vainly trying to get into the air. It ran, leapt, and energetically beat the air with flailing wings, but it had eaten too much. Finally giving up, it tucked its head beneath the wing in shame and went to sleep while waiting for nature to reduce its weight. The young monk chuckled to think that even vultures could eat too much, and he wondered wistfully what it would be like to have even the opportunity of eating too much. He had never had enough. Like most monks, he always felt hungry to some degree. But the tea had to be made, time did not stand still. Putting the can in the fire to heat the water, he passed into the cave to get the tea, the butter, borax and sugar. The old hermit sat waiting expectantly. But, one cannot sit drinking tea for too long when the fires of life are burning low and when an aged man's vitality slowly ebbs. Soon the old hermit settled himself anew while the young monk was tending the fire, the old one's precious fire after more than 60 years without, years of cold, years of utter self-denial, years of hunger and privation, which only death could end. Years when the otherwise complete futility of existence as a hermit was softened by the knowledge that there was, after all, a task. The young monk came back into the cave smelling of fresh wood smoke. Quickly he seated himself before his senior. "In that far-off place so long ago, I was resting on the strange metal platform. The man, my captor, was making clear to me that I was there not for my pleasure but for theirs, to be a repository of knowledge," said the old man. "I said, 'But how can I take an intelligent interest if I am merely held captive, an unwilling, uncooperative captive who has not the vaguest idea of what it is all about or where he is?
How can I take an interest when you regard me as less than the dust? I have been handled worse than we handle a dead body which is to be fed to the vultures. We show respect to the dead and to the living, you treat me as excreta which has to be thrown on a field with as little ceremony as possible.